This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. An abandoned prison doesn't look that promising to most people, but to Noren Sanford, it looks like opportunity. Noren is a licensed clinical social worker and a counselor who works with juvenile offenders. And for him, flipping a prison is the perfect metaphor for transforming futures. Noren founded Growing Change, a nonprofit in Laurinburg, North Carolina, that puts young people who seem destined for incarceration in charge of rehabbing a closed prison. And as they do, they also receive group therapy and a chance to practice being the men they want to be. Noren has been named a Soros Justice Fellow and a Shoka Fellow for his innovative approach to social justice and change, and he joins us now. Noren, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Last time you were on, we talked about the startup and the kind of experiment that this program was, and now things have really moved along. But actually, before I start talking about that, let's talk about what's happening in Scotland County. You are just a little northwest of Lumberton and a little north southwest of Fayetteville. So how are things for you right now after Florence?
Yeah, so our team serves Robeson, Scotland, and South Hope County, and certainly the more the western side of Robeson County. So we have youth leaders from the Pembroke area, and it's been really tough. Our area was flummoxed by what Florence did initially and then the flooding afterwards. Our team at Growing Change has been out clearing lawns and helping neighbors remove trees. We have worn out some chainsaw blades, some chainsaw chains. So, but we come from an area that's pretty innovative and pretty hardy folk. So.
Well, let's talk about that. You grew up in Laurinburg. What was that like for you?
Right. So, born and raised in Laurinburg and grew up. It was an amazing time in the early 80s, late 70s. When I was growing up, certainly our region, because we kind of think of it as a region, there were a lot of challenges, and those challenges somehow have grown seemingly more grim during that time period. But there's always been strengths and assets as well. Like I'm in an area where, as a Caucasian, I'm not the majority. We're about a third African American, a third Native American of the Lumbee Nation, and a third Caucasian, primarily of a Scottish enclave. And that diversity was a significant part of all of our growing up. The opportunity to be connected in fellowship with neighbors and family, perhaps a slower pace of life, our agricultural traditions, and some incredible food. I would put on my top list.
Higher rates of poverty as well.
That's right. We have some nationally significant poverty. If you look at 2014, Lumberton per mid-sized cities was determined the poorest city in the nation. Scotland County often vies for one of the highest unemployment rates. We have some high crime rates. If you look at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation reports, our counties in that area from Columbus to Robeson to Scotland to Richmond often struggle in our public health as well. And so we are certainly not blowing sunshine at anybody. Mm. And we have a group of people who have proven again and again that they're able to weather the storm, so to speak.
Yeah, you talk about these strengths and challenges, and I think this is going to be a theme throughout, and this is also true in your family personally. You had some challenges growing up.
Yes. I grew up with a dad who struggled with alcoholism, and in a small town, I'm sure many listeners can relate to this, that kind of business is hard to keep quiet. It's often in your front lawn. In fact, it often was in our front lawn. And my father, we joked that Noren, my name, was some Scottish derivative of runt of the litter, because at 6'4" and 200 pounds, I'm small compared to my father's people. And so I would be out in the front lawn, scrappy 10-year-old, and my father would trim down to 265, I think, was his fighting weight. So that was a challenge. And it was created some opportunities because, again, your issues were out to the larger community.
Was it something, I wonder, as a young boy growing up, was it even something you thought had to be kept secret, or was this sort of the ground you walked on? It was kind of a normal...
I think all of us, and I'm sure this is not just for our ethnicity, but I drank from the Scott-Irish elixir of denial and bootstrap. And I think I was taught that from the struggle of my father and my father's father and his father before him. So not being able to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
I think creates that kind of isolation that can be dangerous. And like I said, at the same time, having the indicators out to the rest of the community helps break some of that simultaneously.
One lifeline for you, or one way that you found a little more comfort, was with your grandparents at your grandparents' farm. Is that
right? That's right. And this is perhaps driving some of what we're doing today. But high up in the mountains of North Carolina in Madison County, when Madison County was a very, very different place, I worked a Burley Flap tobacco farm. I'm not sure if my grandfather would have said it quite like that. He allowed me to help him some. Might be the best. But my height, my height in Burley Flap was useful as racking tobacco. And I'm not sure if herding the cattle would have been the right term, but giving the cattle exercise from time to time.
Yeah. Being with them.
Being with them, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a balancing. And yeah. Early on for me, I learned that nature itself, whether it was on the farm or the camping and the hiking, backpacking that I quickly got into in Scouts, et cetera, nature was a place to quiet oneself, in a lot of these challenges.
Did it seem, again, at the time to you like a place you were longing for, you wanted an escape? We could call it an escape now, and you can correct me if that's not quite the right word. But did it feel like that? Did you look forward to getting away from what was happening at home?
I did. I knew it was a place of balance, and a place where you could just kind of lay some burdens down. For me, that quietness helped balance some disquietedness, in my personal home, and helped me come back home, in a way that I could do what I could do, being young and in that scenario.
Yeah, so. And your mom obviously had her hands full, and when you did come home, you had a sister who was a close relationship with her. Talk about your relationship with Melinda.
Yeah, so for me, I began in a bit of a misstep because my mother was 46, I believe, when I was born. She literally thought I was menopause until one day I kicked. And so my dad fought World War II in the Army Air Corps. And so I was being raised, my parents were older than, the grandparents of many of my friends. And so I had my oldest sister is about 16 years older than I am. And then I had a middle sister who was 8 years older than I was. And so when I became 8 years old, my sisters would be joking with my mom about our next sibling that should be on the way about then. But of course she would be 53 or something like mm-hmm. that. So Melinda was that middle sister. And she was just a force of nature. She was brilliant. She was an incredible athlete. She was tenacious and set up a strong eddy for me to drop into when I needed to in turbulent waters. Not always the easiest sibling to be raised by, mm-hmm. but my dear mother, who had her hands full, And my father as well my father would later appreciate some of the redirection that Melinda provided all of us constantly.
But maybe not always in the moment.
Not in the moment.
Sadly, she passed away at a very young age.
Yes, when I was 16 and she was 25, 24, we lost her actually up here at Duke North because of her physical health. She could endure all the experimental treatments that were available as they heroically tried to save her. I saw kind of the unthinkable happen. I was able to kind of continue that bootstrap and denial, kind of fashioning myself pulling into the draft of my sister. And so I was watching her torn apart, literally, physically. Yeah, it's pretty aggressive cancer treatment of the early 80s, mid-80s. And so for me, at that point, being an Eagle Scout, being an athlete, team captain, soccer team, earning scholarships that would allow me to attend UNC Chapel Hill, being a youth leader in my community, all those things that I used to cope with my background were no longer as effective. Mm. And that was the beginning of some pretty serious introspection and an opportunity for me to consider life differently.
We'll talk about that introspection, where it led, and what you considered as your life and journey continued. I'm talking to Noren Sanford, the founder of Growing Change, an organization that's flipping a prison in Scotland County and creating new opportunities for young people. Just ahead, we'll hear how he got that idea and why Noren says you should be careful what you pray for. We'll talk about that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Noren Sanford started on his path to becoming a counselor and licensed clinical social worker as a student at UNC Chapel Hill, but it was outside the classroom that he felt most connected and inspired. He got involved in causes from mental health to homelessness, and over the summers, Noren got to work directly with troubled young men, not unlike the ones that he had grown up with in Scotland County. These experiences led Noren to create Growing Change, a nonprofit that leads teams of juvenile offenders to reclaim an abandoned prison and in many ways reclaim their lives. You talked about some of the challenges growing up in Scotland County, a father who truly did struggle with alcoholism. I mean, and occasionally would get on the wagon for a while, but never was able to stay.
Yes, and so my dad would kind of white-knuckle during periods my dad was clear that he loved us. It was difficult at times, and it was also confusing. You know, as a young man growing up, and you don't have that strong star to guide, you know, as to far as what it means to become a man. There's a lot of confusion. I remember our Christmases in particular. Dad would try to keep it together and try to keep it together, and then we'd roll into Christmas time, and it was just too much. And so pretty soon, you know, the Christmas tree would end up in the front yard. And this was a regular event, so I thought, you know, I'm of Scottish descent. We like to throw things. So I thought, all right, maybe this is some kind of, like, pre-Christian tradition that we're going to do
the tossing of the
caber toss. Yeah, caber tree toss. I mean, you just don't know.
Well,
I'm
laughing now, but yeah. It had to be difficult for you at the time, obviously.
It was.
All of this turbulence, trying to make sense of it. And as you say, and I think this is a theme that we're going to want to really go into more detail, this question of how you become a man and what you're watching. Because you're having to adjust, you're having to survive this, so you're making your own structures and your rules now about how to survive, and you're watching some behavior that is not imitable or not behavior that you should imitate. So how do we become a man? An important theme. You lost your sister, Melinda. She was 24. You were 16. You saw her die of leukemia. Tell us about the summers that you spent at Camp Rockfish, because I know that we're going to talk about going to UNC as well, but those were important summers for you.
Absolutely. So as I was, you know, completing my freshman year at Chapel Hill, then there was a decision of, okay, what am I going to do for my summer? I needed to be close enough to my home to be able to take care for my elderly parents and frankly, to be around in case there were medical challenges. You know, my dad broke every law of God and man, you know, in his eating and health. So one would have counted him out, certainly in the mid-80s. But dad lived a long life. And so, but during that time, you know, that's not knowable, especially for a 17, 18-year-old. I found this amazing summer camp. And I had become a Christian as I arrived at Chapel Hill. I had grown up, or at least at least through my high school years, I would say I was a very polite atheist, being in Laurinburg, North Carolina. And
what does it mean to be polite? What is that exactly? How does it manifest?
Well, that meant that I still would attend church because my mother asked me to, and mm-hmm. so that's what I would do. And if asked pointed theological questions, I would give you a long, painful harangue. But they learned to handle me pretty well, and I became president of the youth group as a polite atheist.
And so, wow.
And it was during that time that they, and by they I'm talking about my church community, my larger community, certainly my mom. I remember giving a sermon or a message really from the pulpit after Melinda died and just being really raw and truthful that this was hard for me to understand as a person not of faith, but at that time moving toward faith. After seeing the suffering and putting suffering in the context of the Christ as well. So I arrive at Camp Rockfish, which was Methodist camp, and now my Eagle Scout background, my love of nature, I would really say my need for nature, you know, drew me to this place, and it was 45 minutes, just close enough to home, but not too close, and began working in the woods. I, being 6'4" and 200 pounds, was put in charge of some of the older campers that would come through, coming out of group homes, etc., as those group homes would shut down for repairs and training vacations. And so we would do deep woods work, taking groups out for, you know, a week or sometimes 2 weeks at a time. And that ended up becoming, I think, one of the more significant transformations for me personally. And again, yet another force that helps explain growing change.
You're acting as a counselor, right?
That's right.
You're acting, which puts you in the position of role model and mentor, but
right.
You're coming out of a situation where you hadn't seen much of that. You did find a mentor at the camp that could work, help you as well.
Absolutely. I think many of us, I can only speak as a young man, but many of us who come from similar backgrounds, for whatever reason, when your father is lost, you need to find elements of what it is to be a man through many, many different examples. Some were my father. I'm proud of certain traits. I probably couldn't be doing what I'm doing right now without some of the panache of my father. And I had to fill in a lot of spaces in that mosaic. And so certainly one of those was Bob Pryor, that camp director, who had himself worked with troubled youth for a long time and could recognize my struggle. And remember, when I was a counselor, some of these young people were only 2 years younger than myself and bigger than I was. So I quickly had to get out into the deep woods to have a chance at keeping this group together.
And you did. So talk about the relationship. Was it easy for you? I mean, on the one hand, you might think, well, you can relate to some of their, because of their backgrounds might have been similar. On the other hand, you know, you might be less patient with some of the behavior. I don't know how it was for you.
Right.
Was it?
That's a great question. I think first, coming from my region, again, you know, growing up with the kind of diversity that I grew up in, if you made yourself available, you were able to learn lessons in respect. Now, some of those lessons were a little difficult to take sometimes, but you were able to learn how to show genuine respect out of genuine understanding. And this is before, obviously, we had created words like political correctness. So it was just about respect. I was able to have a certain kind of bounce that allowed me to help coordinate those groups. I also, growing up in my region, I learned to be quick on my feet at a very young age in order to keep my teeth. And so that was a very useful skill. And frankly, I think that was probably the criteria that put me in charge of that group.
Well, so you gained some credibility and respect for that, and I'm guessing for other things as well.
So to be able to lead the conversations in a real way about the struggles, and then to learn that my struggle is as grim as it had been at times, was a lot easier than a lot of others. And so at that moment, to kind of paraphrase Irvin Yalom, I no longer was alone in my despair. And that is a powerful moment when you're able to make those connections. And I think it's because I was able to make those connections that I was successful.
So that's what you're learning from the kids, the people who are going to the camp. Mm-hmm. We talked about Bob Pryor, who's the camp director. What did you learn from him?
Patience and patience and patience. And it's okay sometimes to be silent with someone's grief and suffering. And did I mention patience? Bob had to put up with a lot when you are taking a piece to fit into that father mosaic that you need. I gave Bob some personal grief at times, mm-hmm. when he was dealing with the troubled youth in the form of Nora and Sanford.
Was this a kind of impatience? Like, look, we got to fix this. You're just, you know, standing around here scratching your head, and this child is being lost.
Right. And, you know, of course, now, especially as a therapist, I could see how I was projecting a lot of things. And Bob, you know, this was not new for Bob. Mm. Bob knew what he was doing. And I'm lifting Bob up as an example of, you know, the gifts that were given to me, both at Camp Rockfish, as well as a number of community leaders in Laurinburg, in the surrounding area, at the university, even as late as grad school, you know, where you're still trying to chart that course, right. You know, create that mosaic.
You met one young man, Ernie, who was an important person on the way. Tell us about Ernie.
Well, Ernie will always be kind of that image for me for Camp Rockfish. You know, Ernie appears actually from Durham here. This slightly overweight, slightly uncoordinated young country white kid growing up on a hard side of Durham at that point, and from a family that knew some struggle. And then he appears at Camp Rockfish when he was something like 12 years old. And we really, really connected to Ernie. The ministry really connected, and to Ernie's family. And so Ernie kept coming back, so I had the pleasure of watching Ernie grow and then grow into a junior counselor himself. And then as I came to work here in Durham after college, Ernie and I created a personal friendship, and I was able to see him become a first responder and to become, you know, the man who he was becoming. And for me, it will always be the Ernies that remind me of my camping days. You know, when you see that personal transformation and you see them lay some burdens down.
Where are you now on the journey at this moment, and how is this shaping your idea of your own future? Because we talked about your being at UNC Chapel Hill at this point, as a biology major, right?
That's right. I was a BS biology major, which meant a lot of chemistry, and thank God I also was at a liberal arts school, because I wouldn't have used this language then. I was required to take many other kinds of courses along with a fairly rigorous lab schedule. And I was able to continue to participate in athletics on the fencing team and get involved in the Campus Y. And it's that well-rounded opportunity, I think, frankly, the fact that by the end of my freshman or beginning of my sophomore year, I knew research biology, and specifically working in that lab, was probably not the place that Nora needed to be. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I fit in well in that environment. So I had to retool, but when you're that far into that specific of a major, that meant getting through an undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, there are gifts. I became a botany concentration. And so, again, you see another element of what Grow and Change is about today.
Right. We're talking about the farm, a prison camp that's been transformed into a farm where the youth who are there are actually in charge of the operation. I want to see how you got there and about your decision to become a therapist. Was it a pretty quick transition? Biology's not for me. I'm not meant for the lab. Think I'll become a therapist?
No, I would say that it was during that time continuing to work in the summer camping ministry, but then becoming kind of a para-counselor or a residential counselor at the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics after UNC. And, you know, attending therapy myself, I was diagnosed with PTSD while I was at Chapel Hill and had to take some time out from my undergraduate.
What did you make of that? Forgive me for interrupting this story. We'll come back to it. But what did you make of that diagnosis? You hadn't been to war, because you've got PTSD.
It's a great story about that. I looked across. I can still remember. I looked across at this well-intentioned psychologist who, by the way, had great clinical rapport. And I explained to her that she must have gotten the wrong chart, that if she wanted to go back into the vault, she would need to, because I had not been to war, I couldn't have PTSD, because I knew so much about mental health, right? Clearly, I was not raised in that church. So.
Right, right.
So, and, you know, just very, again, patiently was redirected to some clinical resources, to a therapist, and began working. And it was through that, and then working at the North Carolina School of Science and Math as this kind of residential coordinator, and again, an incredible group of young people that continued to teach me so much, going through getting some perspective on my own issues. It's when I realized that this is the direction that I wanted to take my work, kind of my larger ministry. Mm-hmm. That's what I was feeling called toward.
You did. You became a social worker and then went right back to Laurinburg.
Did I? So as I graduated VCU, completed my honeymoon, I grabbed my Southern Californian newlywed wife and moved to rural North Carolina.
How did that go?
Well, she
was she a Southern Californian?
She
as
was
in
Southern California,
like everything we would imagine.
Yeah. And she moved in. She was a vegetarian.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah. But I wasn't going to say that.
That's right. That's right.
Stereotyping is not right.
Yeah, that's right. So she was a vegetarian who moved into a county that had more hogs in it than people, and we weren't just moving into my hometown. We were literally moving into the modest brick rancher that I grew up in to provide home care for the mother who I loved, but the mother who had Alzheimer's. And so kind of mid-stage Alzheimer's by that point. And so, Frank, we moved into my adolescent bedroom. I still had posters on the wall, like Black Flag, Public Enemy, Those posters were the first to come down.
There are deer carcasses probably on the road in, right? Hanging.
Well,
from
that was a specific agreement that she said that you're not going to hang and gut something in the yard, right?
All right, so there's the transition. Probably more difficult for her than you, but it is a transition for you. Now you're coming back kind of in this role, right?
Absolutely. Well, and I've got good news and bad news. You know, the good news is I'm still married. I mean, that's good news. But the bad news is she's no longer a vegetarian.
So. Okay.
And so it was, and what a transition to see that this place that had such grim challenges in what I felt like was a fairly short amount of time, those challenges had become more grim. You know, this is post-NAFTA. All of our industry was functionally leaving, and there were some bright spots. Campbell Soup opened up, amazing organization. There were, and still are, a few companies partnering with our region. But we had lost a lot of industry, and in that time, we had also lost some hope. Things had become more and more challenging. And so then, as you had the financial housing disaster, and you've had the strong, what we call the Sherman's March of two major hurricanes through our region, when you already have an area that's struggling and it's hit with more and more, the resiliency of everyone is tested. And so in 2000, when I moved back, I began seeing that struggle. And again, keenly aware of our strengths as well, our people, our traditions, our fellowship, our diversity, our resiliency. I mean, we've had to make something from nothing for a long time. And that, so I had to hold more than one thing.
Right, but it's not, and you're back there to help, and you think you can do some good, but it's not going well.
Well, at first, so I began working as a therapist in public mental health, And that was an incredible opportunity. I worked with the general population. We did not have enough resources. Our caseloads were staggering. At the same time, it was incredible work, and began concentrating more and more in working with young people in the court system. Now, I had come from being a provisional therapist and being a student therapist. I had come from more resourced areas, and then I had come from working in Durham as well. And so realizing that when I was working with young people who had some very similar challenges, but we had less resources to deal with them, frankly, using a traditional approach in Laurinburg, we were losing youth to the adult correctional system, or worse.
Well, let's talk about some of the ideas that came to you as you made that observation. When my conversation with Noren Sanford continues, he's the founder of Growing Change, an organization that allows juvenile offenders to create a new path for themselves. That's one of the ideas that occurred to him in this moment. We'll talk more about that just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Noren Sanford today. Grew up in Laurinburg, North Carolina. He now runs Growing Change in Scotland County, organization that's flipping an abandoned prison and working with young people who are actually organizing themselves and doing a lot of the work and doing a lot of the managing. And that is a model. As you say, you went back to Laurinburg to do some counseling and therapy, and you realized that the problems had changed and were of such a magnitude that the old models weren't working anymore.
Yes, and I would say that the traditional models needed to be augmented, is mm-hmm. the way I would say that. And so the traditional evidence-based proven approach is exactly where we should begin. And it can only go so far. And so what do you do after the therapy session? How do young people get support for being able to have a place to live, being able to be safe in their neighborhood, being able to get income in a legal way, being able to get food? If you're not addressing those needs along with a clinical approach, then in a desperate area, the outcomes are going to be obvious.
These are all the rational thoughts that are going through your mm-hmm. mind as you're taking on this caseload that's getting larger by the day. Yep. And then you have a crucial moment that goes well beyond what reason can even handle.
Yes, I think a lot of what's guided me has also been understanding my failures. And I want to be clear. There was a moment that I was standing at a funeral and we were burying a young man who should not have died. And we lost him to gang violence. He was incredibly good with people. He was bright. He was one of the best running backs I've ever seen. And we were burying him. And I had to be real with myself that I had not done everything that could be done to help avoid that. Now, let's be realistic. There are times that you will put everything on the field and the outcomes will still be grim. None of us are in control. It's not about some form of martyrdom. But at that moment, I had to make a gut check that I had become kind of conditioned in this traditional way. And something had to change because I was not going to look back 20 years from then and count would not be in the same place again. So I began a long, earnest prayer, and you made reference before. I really want to tell listeners, be careful what you pray for, because you might want to check the fine print. I was driving through the counties, remember, you know, Western Robinson, Southern Hope, Scotland County, and I had grown up there. And then I realized that we had all these decommissioned prisons laying around in our region. I mean, there's six decommissioned units in a 50-mile radius. And I was working with Native American, African American, Latino, Caucasian young people, often swept up in gang culture, you know, in those counties. And that's when I got the calling to try to figure out something to do with these closed prisons that would be centered around and led by the very same youth that we were serving.
in that moment, did you try to talk yourself out of it?
Yes, Lord.
Because it's monumental and it's crazy in a way. I mean, it's going to make all the sense in the world as we talk about growing change and we talk about how it has proved itself since 2011. But in the moment, you're talking about a thing that you don't know anything about.
Well, you're talking about radical hope. Yeah. And radical hope in a place that struggles is a dangerous concept. It's a dangerous concept. And so one should be careful.
That's interesting. You know, the first thought that occurred to me was the kind of the logistical, like, what am I going to do with a prison? I don't know. But what you're saying is even more powerful in the sense that if you start raising hopes and it doesn't work out, that's the worst thing you can do to yourself.
That's
Nobody
right.
wants to put themselves in that position.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And again, Irving Yalom, we are about the installation of hope. That's at the core function of what we do, not just for our young people, not just for the returning veterans that we serve, not just for the community, not just for state leadership, but for everyone. We are about the installation of hope.
So tell us how you go about this project now that God has spoken and you have given the radical yes to a crazy idea.
Well, prayer is that's really important. There's a lot of times that prayer got me through meetings that wasn't quite sure how that was going to go. But the way it went was in 2011, you know, if you are this person showing up at a place that already has so many challenges, and our leaders of our area and the leaders of the state, you know, are up against some serious challenges. The way they've come together in this latest hurricane challenge has been amazing. And doing so with an already challenged region and infrastructure. But I couldn't be the person to walk into all those meetings and say, hey, I've got this great idea. We're going to flip a closed prison, and why don't you float me some county money? That would be a game ender. So I began competing at the national level for these fellowships, and it was as much about the operational funding as it was about vetting the idea. And then where all of this started is that we literally pulled together a youth team made up of those Native American, African American, Latino, Caucasian youth leaders. And I knew many of them on my caseloads, and this was a completely voluntary group. Now, I did promise to feed them lunch. You might want to write that down. That was one of my best clinical tools. And when I presented the idea to them that, because once they got real with you and stopped giving you the pat answers, they would tell you that by the mid-20s, they expected to be dead or in prison. Now, think about that. If you are 15 years old and that's what you're projecting when you're 24, how will your life be? And so I presented the fact that we were through this program that we were going to create together. We were going to help them reverse that future. We were going to help them flip their prison. And I thought I was the greatest therapist there was. And they all thought that was extremely corny or lame. Until we walked through the 67-acre closed prison in Wagram, North Carolina. And I explained, hey, you guys were chosen to help us lead this. You're going to be part of the leadership team so that we get this right. They no longer thought it was corny at that point. So... And that's where it began.
We'll talk about the vision then. How did you develop that, and what was the idea that emerged from
it? So briefly, we brought together the basic hypothesis of by service learning, we were growing and giving away food to needy families, kind of a free CSA, community-supported agriculture. We're delivering these food boxes to the doorsteps of locally grown, sustainable produce. And through that service learning, we combined with cognitive behavioral therapy, and combined with a focus on professional, personal development for these young people. And through that approach, our hypothesis was to give them the tools to see themselves differently. And then we don't work on self-esteem, we work on self-efficacy, knowing that you can get from point A to point B based on a realistic plan. And then finally, to give them the behavioral opportunity to practice being different in the community when they're shoulder to shoulder with community leaders.
Because they're going to be making the proposal, right? They're going to be taking this thing around. They're the ones going to county and to the foundations and saying, we've got this idea.
They have to approve. They have to approve where we're going next. They help
build
the
show up in some pretty fancy offices. Mm-hmm. There might be some lunches even at those foundations when you show
and
up.
And this is key. The second half of our hypothesis is that while we're at those fancy luncheons, while we're shoulder to shoulder with the leadership, then the leadership have an opportunity to see these young people differently. And in that moment, to see themselves differently. The leadership have an opportunity to practice being different, to behaviorally be different with these youth leaders who are coming back to the village. But here's the most profound thing. You know, Frank, I left a PhD program in psychology to pursue growing change. And at that point, I was kind of ambivalent about dissertations. Now I literally have them falling off trees. There's not even a word for what I'm about to describe, I don't think. But I'm going to call it societal efficacy. Just as we had to work on the self-efficacy for those young people, we have to be able to work on societal efficacy, the confidence in believing that these young people can get from point A to point B based on a realistic plan, because we have some very toxic narratives.
Right. And a fear of hope. I mean, getting back to that initial, we're just afraid to hope that this could turn around.
That's right.
Yeah.
And let's also be clear. I could have created a sustainable farm on much less complicated land in Scotland County, right? And it was significant that we were going to take back work camp prisons that have a whole storied history in and of themselves.
Talk about what they do, because part of it is, I don't know how much background they had in farming, but you're going to have to learn to farm, right, if you don't know how to do that.
That's right. That's right. Some still were connected. Most were not.
Yeah.
And so, but think about that. When they brought in homegrown, vine-ripened tomatoes to the grandmother or great-grandmother who was raising them, well, then there was some societal efficacy in that house, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had to learn many things at once. This is a systems approach. And so we had to learn to tell our own stories. You know, we have a saying that, and we learned this from beautiful folklorist from UNC Chapel Hill. We had to learn that if you need to be able to tell your own story, because other people will tell it and they'll get it wrong. And that's a slogan for us. And it's also a core tradition for us. And so as they're learning to retake their story, then it's also a healing moment for the whole community. And this is very practical as well. So if you lock up one of our young people in juvenile justice for 1 year in North Carolina, you've spent a little over $100,000. How many scholarships is that? So we're able to appeal across the spectrum to both sides of the aisle to make the good argument that we could save the state huge, huge remediation challenges on these sites and continue to serve the greater mission for Department of Public Safety.
You did that in 2011, and it was a kind of a proof of concept.
That's right.
And you proved it because now you're really on your own. So talk about the transition.
5-year clinical pilot program, 2011 through 2016. And we were 92% in preventing entry into the adult correctional system, 92%. But on top of that, or deeper than just that stat, we now have young people who've joined the military, right? I mean, who were headed to destruction. We just attended the Blue Cord ceremony as one of our young men graduated Army Infantry and went through jump school and now is stationed in Italy.
A couple of young men who were on this show a couple of years ago,
That's right.
We talked about that. How are they doing?
So Terrence Smith, it's not all been easy. You know, he's had some struggle, and we have hired him to be our youth director. In fact, of the two employees, myself being one of them, have grown change. He's the second, as well as providing part-time employment for the rest of the youth team currently. And then the other young man who was on the show, Cody, is working construction in our area, and you can imagine he's extremely busy right now.
You've learned a lot through this whole process and kept learning. Talk about, because you've gone into more than agriculture, now into publishing.
Absolutely.
Talk about how that came about, because I think it's a great story.
Well, here's another fortunate failure, I guess, on my part, because I was we had, working with CEFS, one of our partners, and through Cooperative Extension, really Growing Change wouldn't be here without North Carolina Cooperative Extension and our deep partnerships with both North Carolina State and North Carolina A&T State University. We had, I had brought in as a therapist this, on this week-long retreat, an intervention where the young people would create their own storyboard for a comic book, and they would draw out a difficult place in their life, put some script around it, and we would deal with it in group therapy and identify cognitive behaviorally, you know, some features there. And that went extremely well. And these young people, many of whom were kicked out of school, all of whom had been kicked out of school at one point, really took to that. And so then the next week, we're back in Laurinburg, we're having our meeting, and the team brings up, yeah, about that comic book idea, you know, that's a great concept. I think we're going to do that. But now, let me be clear. When we did that, I thought I was the greatest therapist there was. I mean, clearly, this is amazing. I should publish something on this, right? But then at that point in Laurinburg, I'm like, no. That was an intervention. We're really busy learning a lot of other stuff that we don't know about. We can't bring in a comic book. I don't know much about comic books. And they called a business meeting. The business meeting. And this is the format. You know, remember, they're part of the leadership team. And so they called me to a business meeting, which was in St. David's Episcopal Fellowship Hall. And I have 5 minutes long, painful harangue about how we're out of capacity, mission creep, other words that didn't seem to interest them. And they, one, Terrence stood up and said, no, this is a good idea. We've been talking. And don't worry, Noren, you can do it. We'll help you.
Building your self-esteem.
That's right. So now we've got Prison Flip Toolkit. I'm sorry, we got Prison Flip Comics, the Prison Flip Comics that we're really eager to lift off, which would be this electronically integrated comic book idea that lifts up specific stories of the individual youth as they're dealing with pressing issues that we see in juvenile justice and public health, substance abuse.
But this really points to really having the faith in and all of us who want to bring ourselves and our good intentions to a project and our ideas. You really got to let go.
That's right, with
guidance, obviously.
That's right.
and some good structure.
That's right.
There's a lot of good ideas that can come out, and you got to have faith and hope.
Yeah, and listen, and patience. You know, we got to. And then again, you know, we're at a design charrette working with North Carolina State's Design School, amazing organization, and we're putting together this, what would become a nationally award-winning site plan from North Carolina State for the master plan that won the North Carolina Landscape Architectural Award in 2016. But that was a community-based design charrette. And we were sitting around that, 67 group community members in Laurinburg, and we're wondering, what do you do with guard towers, right, on a sustainable farm, those oppressive superstructures? And all of us old people in the room are wringing our hands, and the youth, just exasperated, just kind of say, clearly they're going to become climbing walls, guys. Climbing walls and rappelling stations.
Noren Sanford, the founder of Growing Change, lots more to talk about. Congratulations. You've made it through the trial period, and it's good to see you back. The program is called Growing Change. We have all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Noren, what a pleasure. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.